Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The U, the new Miami, the new Miami, the new Miami, surge, surge, the new Miami, the new Miami, the new Miami, surge, surge.
It's a cane thing when we walk through, with the U ain't no bark, dude, straight dog when we bring the fight, ain't scared of no bright.
All right, welcome back, new edition of the Wide Right Podcast. I'm Manny Navarro, your Hurricanes beat writer for The Athletic. We're recording this right around 1:45 p.m. on Wednesday, December 30. So this will be the final episode of the 2020 year for us here at Wide Right. I've got my producer Mike Zimmerman on the line with me, as well as Walter Villa, the host of Front Page 305 podcast on Sirius XM Radio and a local beat writer here in Miami for many, many years. He and I go way back to the Miami Herald and working together there. Walter was my mentor, helped me come along as a writer. So he is a huge Canes fan, knows all the Canes history, so we brought him on to talk with Mike and myself today following this bowl loss, the Cheez-It Bowl loss by the Hurricanes, 37-34 in Orlando, falling to Oklahoma State. And Miami fans right now, I think, are sort of in that frenzied mode, Walter, where, you know, when you end a season with a bowl loss and then, you know, a regular season loss the way they did to North Carolina, it's fire everybody mode, right? We got to get rid of the coaches. We got to get rid of Blake Baker, the defensive coordinator. We got to make big drastic changes because this team is nowhere close enough to winning a championship, let alone competing in the ACC. And so everybody wants to make drastic changes. As somebody who's seen this program progress over the years, I'm wondering where your mindset is, knowing the history of what it takes to build a winner and how long it takes, knowing what Howard Schnellenberger did, the amount of time he put in, all that kind of stuff. Where is your mind at after what you saw last night?
Well, thanks, Manny, for having me on. Thanks, Mike. I mean, I'm not at all one of those knee-jerk fans and say fire. That never entered my mind, fire everybody. I would say that if there is some – I mean, Manny Diaz made some great adjustments last year to bring in a new offensive coordinator, got the kicker, helped the offensive line with Jared Williams at right tackle, got the quarterback. He made some really astute decisions last year in bringing people in to fix what needed to be fixed. And I think it's more of a case of adjustments. It's interesting, Manny, you would know more. I mean, his relationship with Blake Baker seems to go back. I wonder if he can't make a move because of that friendship. But if there's an established defensive coordinator out there, you know, that would seem to be something that he would need to pursue and maybe reassign Blake Baker within the organization and a position coach or something if his ego would allow. He also has, I think we talked, Manny, last podcast, three scholarships. Seem like those are going to be grad transfers. And there seems to be quite a few places where you can apply those scholarships to fix some holes. So, no, I don't think at all it's about fire everybody. It's about making some more astute decisions, some adjustments. But Manny and Mike, I want to get your take as well as a big Canes fan. I mean, to me, I had two major questions. Manny, should I ask one at a time or both?
Well, I think we can do it one at a time, and that way we can tackle each of them head on. But go ahead.
All right. So the first one is wide receiver. That was obvious. Those guys were bad. Pope was bad. Wiggins was bad. I mean, Harley, I have no problem with his body of work this year, but. It's not just this game. It was all season long, the drops, the lack of production. Pope came in here as a five-star, has never lived up to that billing. And so my question for you guys and the coaches is, why didn't they play freshmen early on in the season, give them more and more responsibility? You know, he's not averse to playing freshmen. He played Chaney and he played the Rooster, and those guys were terrific. Obviously, the Rooster got hurt, but Chaney – last night, and he's continued to look better and better. Keyshawn Smith, Manny, do I have that kid's name right?
Yep.
Okay, I'm the name murderer, but Keyshawn Smith, I've been impressed with him every time he's been on the field this year, getting his deep speed, kid out of San Diego, getting behind defenders. Last night, he made a great, almost a diving attempt in the end zone on the sideline. The pass was a little bit errant by Nikosi. He couldn't quite get it. But, man, great effort. You know, I think Restrepo, from his body of work in high school, you know, I like my dad's Worsham. The other kid, I mean, they've got about three or four freshmen and a redshirt freshman. That why haven't those guys been given more responsibility? And maybe at this point of the year, they wouldn't have to be turning to Wiggins and Pope again and again and have them fail.
Well, we can start with wide receiver. And Mike, I'm going to kick it to you next. But I think, look, Walter, I've been around football enough and around enough teams, and you have as well, that when guys don't play, it's because the coaches really believe they're not ready. It's not because I think, you know, they have some sort of loyalty to Mark Pope and D. Wiggins where it's like, okay, we still have to throw these guys the ball and give them a chance. I don't think so at all. I just think it's more of a situation where these freshmen maybe don't know enough of the offense and don't run the routes well enough or don't block well enough. Here's a couple interesting notes. And this is.
But wait, Manny, wait. Yes, that's why I don't think it was loyalty. That's what they think. But isn't it also true that they could be wrong? Because when we've seen Keyshawn out there, he's done well. Maybe they're just wrong.
Not only that, though, but you have Wiggins and Pope who aren't even doing the number one job of a receiver, which is to catch the ball. So if you're saying the young guys, say like Keyshawn Smith and Redding and all these young guys who aren't getting on the field because the coaches don't believe they're ready, well, Pope and Wiggins aren't really doing much to stay on the field either.
Right.
Agreed.
No, I understand. And I think more than anything, they're in there for their blocking. And I know that sounds hysterical.
Yeah.
But
Wiggins would have stayed on his block in the end zone. He did do a good job of that. I agree. But to not give these freshmen, I agree with Zim, not give them any run during the year, hardly at all. I just don't agree with that.
Right. I think here's – and I'll give you some numbers because I'm a numbers guy and I want the facts out there, right? People always ask, well, how much did they play? Well, last night they went to Keyshawn Smith for 15 snaps. He was in there for 15 snaps. Michael Redding, who caught the last pass, that wide receiver screen on 4th and 8 or whatever it was that he got 5 yards – he was in for 8 snaps. That was it. That was it for the freshman. Jeremiah Payton didn't play. Xavier Restrepo didn't play. Dazlin Worsham didn't play all season. Dazlin Worsham played 1 snap the entire year.
Can't forget about Marshall Few, though.
Marshall Few came in on the 2-point conversion. That was his 1 snap, and he scored on the trick play. So that's what you had at wide receiver. And for the season, by the way, for long-term view, for what they did in 11 games, Payton was in on 143 snaps. So what is that? You do the average. It's about
10, 11 snaps a game.
10, 11 snaps a game, right? Keyshawn Smith in for a total of 107. And then Michael Redding, 67. Restrepo, 29. And like I said earlier, Worsham, 1. Those were your freshmen, redshirt freshmen, you know, your young guys, how much work they actually got. So I think part of it, another aspect to all this too, you know, obviously the COVID-19 pandemic hit, and there were several guys in the receiver core that ended up missing games and time because of that. I don't know how much practice time that included, but certainly I think that affected things. The fact that they only had 4 spring practices. Look, I'm not trying to make excuses.
I was going to say, because every program in the country has dealt with this too. You know?
Right.
And also, Manny, how many times have we seen, we say, oh, they're not ready because they're not showing up practice, which that may be true, but it's something I can't argue with because I'm not there at practice to see if they are ready or not. All I can see is the games. And as Mike points out, all I can see is the lack of production from Wiggins and Pope. And yes, Wiggins, you know, I saw him in particularly that play in the end zone doing a great job blocking. That's fine. But it is demoralizing when you drop those passes. I mean, Nikosi actually did a good job. Not his body language wasn't bad. Those drops would be demoralizing. If any of the three of us were the quarterback, we'd be like, come on. Especially the little quick screen. Manny, that was to Pope, I think you told me.
Yep.
That was a touchdown, and they ended up settling for a field goal. So that's 4 points that we gave up right there, and that couldn't have been any easier. I mean, it's just demoralizing. And so the point is, how many times have we seen guys that the veteran starter not doing well, and they get injured and they're forced to go to the backup, and then all of a sudden the backup plays really well, you know, I don't know, Jeremy Lin, New York Knicks, Linsanity, or any other case that you come up with. And then, like, well, why weren't we playing this dude before?
Right. Well, and here's an example for your argument, Walter. The kid who lit up Miami yesterday, Brennan Presley, who had six catches for 118 yards and three scores?
One catch, 7 yards.
The entire season, right. 5'8", 165-pound former three-star recruit. So
Thank you.
So, look, it's not that I wanted to argue it one way or the other. I was just explaining what their thinking is versus what happened. And to me, I look at it as this. At some point, Rob Likens and Coach Lashley, Rhett Lashley, they had to have had a conversation over this. Had they not? I mean, there had to have been some sort of, hey, we need to get the freshmen in more. We need to involve them. But they didn't. And I don't know who that ultimately falls on. I don't know if that's Rob Likens' call. I don't know if that's Rhett Lashley's call. Either way, the job wasn't done. And I think, you know, we're going to sit here and debate, you know, Blake Baker more. We're going to debate a bunch of different topics because I know you have another question you want to get to, Walter. But I think as fans and as listeners of this podcast, you need to understand that every decision that's ultimately made, I don't think falls on one person. Miami's group as a whole, collectively, all these decisions are made together. Manny Diaz doesn't make, you know, independent decisions by himself, even though he's the head coach.
There's got to be accountability then. Like you can't just say as a collective unit we've failed. Sure, that may be true, and all those things that you're saying may be true, but if there aren't changes that are made, you're going to get the same results.
And that's why. And then ultimately, it is Manny Diaz. He is the head coach, right?
And that's one thing we can say because I do defend. I'm bringing up two questions I have for the coaching staff today, but I do defend Manny Diaz, as you know, Manny, your namesake there. I defend Diaz a lot, and he is accountable because he showed that last year. How many coaches, including going back to Al Golden, that there was a criticism and it seemed like it was just made him more and more stubborn and didn't listen to what was obvious that the fixes that need to be made. So I think he is responsive to what's obvious. And I think the wide receiver, it was glaring last night, but that's not knee jerk. Mike, wasn't that the whole season? Almost every week. There was one game where it was really bad. I think it was Clemson. And then they opened up the job for everybody. And then Harley was the one guy that really responded. So I leave Harley out of it. I thought he had a nice year, but Wiggins and Pope, they got way, way, way too much playing time.
So I've got two things without getting all over the place because we have a lot to cover. But for in terms of the wide receiver position, it almost seems like because there was a feeling that the young freshmen and the younger players weren't going to get on the field, it was like Pope and Wiggins became complacent. They knew they weren't going to lose their jobs, and it looked like they weren't, I guess, willing to get better or even work on, you know, pass catching after practice, you know, whatever. It seemed like they weren't worried about losing their jobs, which also then brings me to the second question, which I'd love to get your opinions, guys, because I'm not sure, and maybe I'm thinking too much into this, but does this ultimately feel like that this was a big year where Manny Diaz needed to win at all costs, so he figured these older guys, give them the best chance to win? Because was he just trying to save his job this year after going 6-7 last year and said, I don't have time to develop these guys for the future. I may not have a job after this season.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It's a good question, Mike. I haven't really ever thought of it that way. I think the most practical sense, the one that makes the most sense to me, is of course Manny Diaz had to have been somewhat rattled by going 6-7 last year, and he's desperate to win. But in the end, he still played the guys that he thought could help him win the best, and that was Pope and Wiggins. And again, is it more of an indictment that he decided to play for them and didn't play the freshmen and invest in developing those guys? Or is it more of an indictment on the previous coaching staff for not recruiting well enough, some guys to come in and replace them? The same thing at the linebacker position, right? I mean, nobody was really ready to come in and replace Shaq Quarterman and Michael Pinckney. I don't know. I don't. It's a hard question to answer. I don't think Manny Diaz was coaching scared, like, oh, I'm gonna lose my job this year, so I have to play Pope and Wiggins. I just honestly think he and his coaches thought that those guys, you know, right, were gonna make catches in games, and they were gonna come up with the plays. And
I agree, Navarro. I think that's what he thought. But all I'm saying is, coaches are wrong all the time, all across the country, in every sport. And I think it may have been the case where he was wrong. He thought he played the guys that – I believe that he played the guys that would give him the best chance to win, but I also hold out the possibility that he was wrong, that he didn't develop these guys that could have been an answer, not down the road, could have been an answer this year. And actually, I think Mike made a great point about fear of losing job. That goes in every industry. As journalists, if you screw up and there's no accountability, well, you're just going to – not that you're trying to screw up, but that you know if you screw up again – that there's no accountability. And you know, I think that's a theory that goes across any industry. And we saw it in the punt return. They had the problem again. But, you know, I think at least they took him out. I think it was Harley who fumbled. But there really have been anybody he's tried. I don't hold him as accountable in the punt return issues, because how many dudes has he tried there? And they all basically couldn't make a fair catch. So, but at wide receiver, I feel a little bit differently. I don't think he tried different guys enough. And again, I Keyshawn Smith, because that's the one we probably saw. He was the most impressive young guy. Would you agree, Mike?
Yeah, I also think, because that's he's the one who we've seen the most of. He's got more of a sample size than the other young guys. I mean, I was a little disappointed just because, based off the hype, that we haven't seen more of Jeremiah Payton.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that I had some high hopes considering all the hype around this kid, especially during practice and everything. And then it's almost like we just don't see him. Now, I don't know whether that's just on him that he hasn't been practicing well, or whether it's just the coaching decisions.
Guys, yeah. I I'm going to throw more numbers at you just because this is sort of a season wrap-up. Just so you know, where D. Wiggins and Mark Pope ranked according to Pro Football Focus, this is among the 51 wide receivers who I basically did 20% of their team's targets. So they were targeted at least 26 times. They had the ball thrown their way. So there were 51 receivers in the ACC, including Notre Dame, that were targeted at least 26 times. Pro Football Focus rated Mike Harley 8th. Okay, this is overall for his grade. And then D. Wiggins was 49th and Mark Pope was 47th. That's how bad that's how poorly they thought of Miami's receivers just in the ACC.
And I guess the point that I think we're all trying to make, or at least, you know, I guess wondering why, is that any of these young receivers probably couldn't do any worse, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can only be ranked 50th or 51st, right?
Yeah, out of 51, right.
That's what I mean. So you can't – these young guys wouldn't be able to do any worse than Pope and Wiggins. And I'm not trying to rip on them. You know, it's just, I guess it's frustrating seeing that it's been a season-long thing. And frankly, it's been a 2 to 3 year, you know, thing with them. It's just they really haven't developed and grown. Drops have been a huge part of their careers.
Yeah. And also what we heard about Keyshawn, kind of, it goes with what we've seen, the limited chances he's gotten. What did we hear about him? This was not a possession, not like Daz and Restrepo, that were more like maybe a slot receiver. This is a guy that his reputation, he was going to get deep. The stats he had in San Diego sort of indicated that. And then when I saw him, he was getting behind defensive backs a lot, in given how little he was throwing the ball. And so I'm excited about him, and I'm disappointed that he didn't get more opportunities. But anyway, I think we covered that, Navarro. What do you think? Should I go to my next question?
Go ahead, Walt. I know you got more.
No, this is my only, really my second big, I mean, I can talk about whatever you guys, but my two big questions for the coaches, I think the wide receiver, that's the first one. And the second one, Navarro, you and I kind of touched on this last podcast, and I think disagree with Kelvin when he said there was nothing the coaches could have done. And I think, Mike, you agree with me that there could have been. I think last night showed there was something they could do to stop the run. That was a much better performance against the run. They seem to be run blitzing, putting more bodies in the box, so much so that Oklahoma State came out and they saw the defense and they just threw the ball. It seemed like the first 90 snaps. I'm exaggerating, but you look at the averages, Navarro, you're the numbers guy, but they're running backs, 3.0, 2.1, and one of those guys ran for 200 yards a couple games ago. They after Chuba Hubbard went down, they had at least one guy go over 100 every game that he was gone. So that's a good running team. So the question is, if they made that adjustment for Oklahoma State, why couldn't they have made that adjustment in game against North Carolina? Not to say it would have been a victory because they spanked the Hurricanes, but force them to do something different than just hand the ball off and run all over Miami.
Well, I'll start with this. It was 21-0 by the time Miami's defense got off the bus, right? It was
right.
It was pretty bad right away. And they Oklahoma State came out throwing the ball. They didn't run their first designed run, meaning where the quarterback didn't take off and scramble. They didn't run their first designed run until the 16th play of the game. And they were already well on their way to that 21-0 lead. And the first carry, by the way, went for 29 yards. So while Miami's final numbers looked good, I think – Oklahoma State finished with 113 yards rushing, a 2.6 average for the game. They ran it 43 times. I think you have to –
It was much better, Manny. It was much better.
It was, but I think it also was a product of a team that a situation where they were trying to throw the ball and expose Miami's passing game, and they did.
Not only that, though, but you have to remember Chuba Hubbard wasn't playing either.
Right, but in the three games after Chuba, they had one kid, I think it was Alexander, whatever his name was. He had 200-something yards. Mm-hmm. They're still a good running team. I'm saying they made an adjustment. They made Oklahoma State do something else. You first have to stop the run and to let North Carolina do what they did. I mean, to me, Mike, if I look at the season in its entirety, 8-3, had Miami beaten North Carolina and lost the same way in the bowl game, obviously they would have played a different team, but let's say they lost in a similar fashion. Down 21-0, they lose King, they battle back, they're in position to win. There's nothing to hang your heads about. You know, the loss to Clemson, there's, you know, obviously way better than Miami. And the loss to Oklahoma State, the only one to me that sticks out like a sore thumb that's really embarrassing was that performance in North Carolina, where they just let them hand the ball off and stick it to Miami, though. I mean, that was embarrassing.
I would agree with that. I would also throw in a couple games like the NC State game. I would even argue, despite the scoreline, the Pitt game was – there weren't adjustments made. You know, even the Virginia Tech game. It's just I from watching the games, yes, they won. And we've talked about this plenty of times where last year's team wouldn't have won those games. But – it just seems like these are bad teams that Miami's playing. They're not very good. They're average. And they're struggling, not making any adjustments at all, letting these average teams hang in this game, take leads in the fourth quarter, and it's just ugly. And maybe that's the next step compared to last season. Maybe that is. But well, it just did not seem like Miami was an 8-3 team this year.
It didn't feel that way at the end. Certainly losing a bowl game for the 10th time in 11 years. Like I wrote in my story today, only one of those 11 bowl trips was even to a New Year's Day bowl game. You know, the Orange Bowl. One time to the Orange Bowl. The rest of them were all sort of mid-level bowls. And so you lose 10 out of 11 of those. And it's just there's a general consensus of, man, here we go again. Another crappy finish to a season. But to answer your question, Walter, and to kind of piggyback off of some of the things you said about the defense and how they played all season long, in my story today, I put together a chart sort of looking at all of Miami's opponents, what they averaged per game in terms of points and yardage, and then what they did against Miami. And I figured that's a good way to compare. You know, did Miami hold those teams in check to what they normally do, or did they, you know, give up much more? And to Mike's point, you know, you look at the end of the season, NC State 41 points, right? At 44-41, you had to win that game. NC State averaged 31 points a game. North Carolina, they were sixth in the country, averaging 43 points a game. You give up 62 to them. And then this Oklahoma State team was pretty average offensively. Even with the good running game, they were averaging 29.5 points per game, which was 57th in the country, and you give up 37 points to them. So three out of your last five games weren't very good. And something else to point out, Miami, when they gave up the 41 points to NC State, that was with their backup quarterback. A week later, when they played Virginia Tech and they were in a dogfight to win that game against a very average to bad Virginia Tech team, Khalil Herbert was still injured. He didn't get a whole lot of work in that game.
Pittsburgh, too. Kenny Pickett was out as well.
Right. Kenny Pickett was out for Pittsburgh as well. So when you look at this defense and you try to stick a fine-tooth comb right through it and say, okay, where's the BS and what's real? I think what's real is they got lucky that they didn't play very many good teams this year. I think they weren't exposed as bad as they could have been, particularly at the linebacker position. And I would say in the secondary as well. I mean, they didn't face – I mean, yes, they got Trevor Lawrence and they gave up 42 points to Clemson. Clemson averages close to 45 a game. They're the third highest scoring team in the country. But, you know, they faced a bad Florida State team. They faced a Louisville team that they gave up 34 points to them. It's not like they dominated Louisville. I don't know. I mean, I think things could have been a lot worse had they played a tougher schedule with better offensive players. And they were fortunate that they only faced, you know, an Oklahoma State team without Chuba Howard and without really their best receiver, who opted out, by the way, in the middle of the game, right? I mean, how weird was that? I'm only going to play the first half of the bowl game. So, look, I think there's changes have to be made on this defense. I don't know if you fire Blake Baker. I don't know if you get rid of Mike Rumpf because he's not maybe recruiting the best players in his own backyard. All of those issues, like, I don't know what the perfect answer is. I just know that right now Miami isn't good enough to play for an ACC championship. They're not good enough to get into the college football playoff, and that's what you want if you're a Miami fan. You want to play in the big games. You want to play in the meaningful games. Now, you have to give Manny Diaz time, right? This is his second full recruiting class. He has, I think they're ranked 11th right now in 247 Sports. The year before, they were 16th. They've put together two good recruiting classes. They've gotten two good quarterbacks in Tyler Van Dyke and Jake Garcia. Year three is going to be a huge year. We got to see what Manny Diaz does with this group of players and what, you know, if they can get a full spring practice in 15 practices, how does that help player development? But this is the put up or shut up time for Manny Diaz and playing Alabama in the opener, the number one ranked team in the country, who's probably going to win the national championship this year, is really doing him no favors. I mean, right off the bat, you have the ultimate measuring stick. Nick Saban and Alabama, the team that's absolutely dominated college football for the last 10 to 15 years. And I don't know. We're going to get our answers here soon, but I think Manny Diaz, you know, he needs Brevin Jordan to come back. He needs Mike Harley to come back. He needs some of these guys on this team who carry a big stick and do a lot of the damage for them to come back, because if not, the pressure's really going to be on him to do a good job here and to make the right kind of changes, to make the change of coordinator if he needs to do that, or to hand it to somebody else. But they're in a spot right now, Walter, where I look at the end of the season, I say, man, they would have certainly been better off not playing those last couple games, because I think in a lot of ways it exposed some of the things that maybe we didn't see when they were 8-1.
Well, yeah, and as Mike said, that's been a pattern ever since that really became noticeable that year under Rick. I think it was 2017, where they were 10-0 and they faded, lost their last three, and that's been a pattern of not finishing strong. But before I get to that, I wanted to say that's why the athletic readers and the listeners to the podcast love Navarro, because, you know, I shoot from the hip and Navarro backs everything up with the numbers. Something when I was his editor at the Miami Herald, I always noticed the Manny Navarro research. So I just wanted to give a shout out to that. But I also wanted to follow up, Manny, and ask you. So, and Mike pointed out some of the other, I kind of like minimize the deficiencies in the defense when the Canes won the football game. Like, but you did a good job of pointing it out, Mike, but hey, it's a win. And so I kind of forget about it a little bit, But it's true. There were deficiencies there throughout the season. So Manny, my third question is, how wed do you think Diaz is to Baker? I know there's a brotherhood there going back to whatever their previous coaching stops. Do you think Diaz, you know, would be able to, you know, those things are tough, man. You know, when you're friends off the field and whatever, do you think he has it in him that says, hey, if there's a great guy out there for defensive coordinator, that he would make that move?
Please don't tell me this is Golden D'Onofrio 2.0.
You know, that's a really hard question. And that I think ultimately will define whether or not Diaz is the coach here long term, because there's a couple layers to this, Walter. Number one, I think we need to identify that every coach in college football likes to have friends or people who execute what they want them to do around them, right? People that he trusts.
Their vision. Execute their vision.
Execute their vision, right. Ephraim Banda, the safeties coach, he's here. Why? Because he's been with Manny Diaz for almost a decade now, including his other stops, Texas and Louisiana Tech and everywhere else that he's been. Blake Baker, sort of the same thing. He was with him at Louisiana Tech, and they obviously have a friendship. And ultimately, I think cutting off your friends and making a decision to change things up, there's two layers to that. You're kind of putting the blame on somebody else, right? If you're Manny Diaz, you're saying these guys aren't getting the job done. I don't see that. I think Manny has made it pretty clear in the press conferences over and over and over again that this is a collective effort, right? That's what he likes to say. This, we were all in the meetings together. We're all part of the game planning. So I think from his perspective, whether or not he's lying to us in the media, it's the message that he's putting out there, that this is a collective effort. So it's not just on one guy. So that he's.
But wait. They're all part of the game plan, and he still fired two coaches last year.
Well, you fired him on offense, which is an entirely different thing, because let's not forget, Manny Diaz, his entire bread and butter is defense, right? I mean, that's what he came up doing. He's been coaching defense from the get-go. That's who he is. He is a defensive coach who is trying to become a head coach. That's what he's doing. This is year three. This is going to be year three of learning on the job as a head coach. He's never been a head coach anywhere else in his career. So that's the first layer, is can you fire your friends? Dan Enos and Stubblefield, who's now at Penn State, those weren't his friends. Those were offensive hires. Now it's does Manny Diaz have the gusto, the guts to pull off a firing and change? Now that's one aspect, the friend aspect. The second aspect is a philosophical approach, because let's not forget, this is his defense, right? They're running his defense. The whole tackles for loss, sacks, put pressures on the quarterback, play man-to-man, all of that is his philosophical approach to playing defense. If Manny Diaz fires Blake Baker, is he going to bring in another friend to run the same defense? Then why are you firing Blake Baker, right? To me, does Manny Diaz have the guts as a head coach to say, okay, maybe my approach isn't the right way? Maybe my approach the last two games has gotten us into big-time trouble. We got absolutely embarrassed by North Carolina, and Oklahoma State came out and shoved it right down our throats for 21 straight points to begin the game.
The best head coaches always adapt and put pride second. I mean, I'm not comparing Nick Saban to Manny Diaz by any stretch of the imagination, but an example is Nick Saban was a traditional guy who liked to have a ground and pound offense, right? When he realized that's not working anymore, he started hiring offensive coordinators who ran the spread, high tempo, like, you know, used athletes in space, adjusted to where college football is, you know, in the present. And I think as a head coach, sure, Nick Saban wouldn't have said to you even 5 years ago, you know, that's his style of offense. But he adapted, and I think Manny Diaz would need to, if he believes that philosophically it's not getting it done. I don't think there's any harm in swallowing your pride and saying, let's try something different.
And that's the thing here, is that I don't know that he has the wrong approach. I think this is the way that you have to play defense, in terms of, you know, being aggressive, trying to create negative plays, put teams in third and long, all those kind of things. I think where Manny Diaz has failed, and I've said this on the podcast before, guys, to both of you, it's the recruiting aspect of it. He didn't have anybody ready to replace his two starting linebackers in Shaq Quarterman and Michael Pinckney. Just didn't. Those guys weren't ready for this year. And he was counting on injured guys and guys who sat out, like a Zach McLeod, to come back and be ready to fill that need. And that's where the indictment to me is on Manny Diaz as a head coach. Is, does he know how to read talent well enough? Does he know how to read a roster well enough? Does he know how to read the depth chart well enough where he can anticipate, if we have a problem here, we have somebody who can step up and fill that role? And, you know, the recruiting for the last couple of years, especially the cornerback position, Al Blades, okay, he had moments, but for the most part, you go and you look at the PFF grades, he's below average. DJ Ivy, same thing, right? Big, strong corner, four-star kid out of South Florida, doesn't get the job done enough. To Corey Couch, three pass interference penalties. Maybe they weren't all on him yesterday. Maybe some of them were bad calls, but still, I mean, the point is,
Gervin Hall hasn't lived up to the hype.
Gervin Hall has not played well this year. Bubba Bolden's been up and down. Amari Carter's had his issues. So
that's why, Manny, I think it's not so much the recruiting. That's why I think Manny Diaz, I have a lot of faith in him. And after last year, we had the famous podcast where you call him a buffoon, and I defended him, and I still will defend him. He made the adjustments after last offseason. I have faith he's going to make the adjustment. Now, I don't know what coordinator is out there that he thinks is going to be a significant improvement, but I think if he's smart, and I think he is a smart guy, he's the CEO of the team. He's not the defensive coordinator anymore. Mm-hmm. And if somebody can come in, I think it was just so exciting for the team. If somebody comes in with a different approach, even just small adjustments to make, I think it's more than the recruiting. I think it, and you mentioned to Corey Couch, who's a young man, you know, slight of frame. He's made a big impression on me this year. The guy's got a lot of, can we say cojones on the show? He's got a lot of cojones. But that seems to me a little bit of a coaching adjustment, like the hands. He was too handsy, but he was, man, I like the kid's aggressiveness. That's just a slight adjustment. If he can still be close to those receivers, breaking on the ball, and just not, there was another one at the goal line. I forget who who got flagged. If you remember, the Oklahoma State was in the red zone, and there was no reason. I don't know if it was Gervin Hall. There was no reason to put your hands on the receiver, and yet he did. He got thrown for the flag. There was just that has to be a little bit of a coaching thing, and I just think there's an opportunity here again for Manny Diaz to interview a bunch of people, get some new ideas, approach this in a fresh way, because I think they do have a lot of athletes year in, year out. And Manny, you've done a lot of that research, compared Miami recruiting to Duke and whatever. And we have tons of good athletes. It may be a question, just like Rhett Lashley was to reinvigorate this offense, that somebody come in here with some different ideas and reinvigorate the defense. And you're right, it is going to be a test of Manny Diaz of really thinking, now that the season's over, and we've got a month to the next recruiting date, to really think this thing through. And maybe he doesn't have to fire Blake Baker. Maybe he makes him, the linebacker coach or something. I don't know. But I think he's got a lot of soul searching to do now.
Yeah. And I just think overall, like, that's a part when you hire a guy like Manny Diaz, you know, who's been a defensive coordinator's whole career, and he's never had head coaching experience. This is part of what you pay for. It's learning on the go, right? It's learning from your mistakes.
And that's normally why first-time head coaches start out at smaller schools.
Yes. And I think
that,
like, who you
perfect
said,
example.
Well, I mean, look, he made the changes after year one. Now it's year two. Will he continue to do that? And the friendship factor is certainly a part of it all. And then I think also, like I said, the second layer is philosophical standpoint. Does Manny Diaz have the guts to be a Nick Saban and say, I might have to change my approach. I may have to really put this defense in the hands of somebody else and trust them and put my career on the line for them. And I don't know what Manny Diaz is thinking. I don't know if he's thinking I just should, you know, go back to being a defensive coordinator and slash head coach. But I know that something has to change, because the defense this year was exposed, and it's not championship level. When you give up 7,000 million yards to North Carolina, it's just not championship level. And again, everybody wants to point the finger at Blake Baker. Walter, real simple. Who recruited every defensive player on this roster? Was it Blake Baker or was it Manny Diaz?
Manny Diaz.
It's his players. It's his players. He signed off. He coached up. He did everything with this defense. So, look.
That's why I'm saying I put myself, again, Manny, I put myself in Diaz's shoes. I would bring coaches in. And they don't have to say, you know, you get to listen. Hey, tell us what we did wrong. And you listen to all these ideas. You add a coach or two to the staff. I think it's a real good if he's willing to sort of take that advice. And because I know Manny Diaz, first thing in the morning, he's going to listen to this podcast. Am I right, Navarro?
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, if you bring in coaches and you ask them, hey, what would you do differently? Take, because that's what coaches, they come in and say what they would do. I think he has a chance. He showed last year. He impressed me last year. And Mike, I'm pretty sure with you as well, that he was willing to make changes. He's willing to analyze. It didn't take him 3, 4, 5 years, which he know he didn't have 3, 4, 5 years. He needed to change things right away. We've seen coaches, Al Golden, who didn't make those adjustments. So I'm optimistic that he will look at this with some fresh eyes, maybe bring in some new coaches and make some adjustments. I like the aggressiveness. I like the tackles for losses. But there are times when you have to run a zone blitz and have eight in coverage and throw different wrench into it. There is some teaching tools, you know, the hands, you know, on the receivers, which you just can't do in today's game. Amari Carter, how many times was he penalized for trying to blow a play up instead of like running in front and breaking on the ball and getting the interception? I mean, we just can't play that type of football anymore. So I and Mike, I'm sure you have a lot of other examples this year of adjustments that weren't made. I think there's a lot of this, as much as I am the defender of Manny Diaz, a lot of this is on the coaching, on adjustments they can make going forward.
Well, that's why I think, like I said, whoever wants to take the blame, whether Manny Diaz is saying it's a collective thing or you want to put it all on Blake Baker or all on Manny Diaz, whoever, you can't go into next season with the same coaching staff and everything the same.
Yeah,
I agree. You just can't do that, especially without Quincy Roche and Jalen Phillips. For the most part this season, those two guys kind of bailed out Miami a lot, especially in the pass rush area.
I will say this. Last night, Miami, in terms of tackles for loss, matched their season average. They had 9 tackles for loss. They average 8.6 per game in the regular season. So in terms of production, without those two guys, without their two main pass rushers, and they were able to get to the quarterback and get some hits on the quarterback, and they were able to, you know, Jafari Harvey had a sack and a strip that Oklahoma State recovered, but he did get to the quarterback and knock the ball out of his hand. So that was an encouraging sign, at least from the perspective of replacing Roche and Phillips.
Yeah, a lot of it was missing too. Was I was talking to another buddy of mine after the game, was the playmaking. You know, even the one where there was I'm not sure if it was that one where they hit the quarterback and the ball fluttered up in the air about 15 yards. And, you know, I'm thinking, where's Ed Reed to pick that off, Sean Taylor to pick that off and go to the house? And they get a completion out of it. I mean, there was the fumbles that were there to be had. We don't scoop it up and score. We don't even recover it. There were just playmakers missing. That was pretty glaring. When that ball goes up in the air, you remember the one I'm talking about, Navarro?
Yeah, that was the first or second drive of the game, yeah.
I mean, you just shake your head. Like, where's the reaction? Where's the linebacker? Where's the safety coming up and picking that ball?
Well, I mean, I think that falls again on the linebackers, and it shows you how poor those guys have been all season. Like that to me is in a linebacker area. The cornerbacks are down the field. The safeties are down the field covering in coverage. And so to me, that's where, you know, a guy like Corey Flagg, who's, you know, he's a true freshman. If he's on the field and he's got a little bit more experience under his belt, he's probably there to make that play. Bradley Jennings did catch an interception off of deflection that was wiped off. But again, Bradley Jennings, it always feels like he's normally a step slow. Wayman Steed started yesterday at linebacker because they wanted to put McLeod at defensive end. McLeod actually had 5 I think pressures on the opposing quarterback, according to Pro Football Focus, which was the most on the team, although he never got to the quarterback. He just put pressure. So I don't know, man. I don't know what the answer is. I think playmakers is the right word. I think James Williams and Leonard Taylor are two playmakers. I think Avante Williams is a playmaker. They've got guys waiting in the wings to be playmakers.
But Manny, we've said that about every highly touted prospect coming into Miami. And
no,
I think,
you're right.
And I think this kind of goes back to what we've talked about the past year and a half on this podcast, is that there has been no player development at the University of Miami. There have been very few players who have walked in as a freshman and have left a better player. And I think that's a big reason why there's really no depth at linebacker. I think that's why a cornerback position is below average, because none of these players have come in as a freshman and gotten better. Everybody is still the same player, and you can't have that level of production.
Well, a couple of things are going to change here in this next NFL draft. First of all, there's going to be a first-round pick on the defensive side of the football at Miami for the first time since 2016.
Yes. Maybe more than one.
2016 was the last time Miami had somebody on their defense drafted in the first round, and that was Artie Burns, okay? But even before that, you go to Artie Burns, who was the previous first-round pick on defense before Artie Burns? Kenny Phillips.
Yep.
2008. So you've had one first-round pick on defense in 12 years. I mean, after Ray Lewis, Ed Reed, and the amount of guys that have come out of this program, to say that sentence is just insanity to me. So you're going to have Gregory Rousseau, who people will say was developed because he was a three-star kid who you know, grew into his body and played well for a season. You're going to have Jalen Phillips, who's going to be a first-round pick because he's former number one overall recruit that Miami happened to get in the transfer portal. One of Manny Diaz's very good pickups in the transfer portal. But beyond that, I think you can look at the rest of this roster and say, okay, where are the next first round picks, right? Where, I mean, is Nessa Silvera going to be a first round pick? No.
But Manny, we're not even talking first round picks. I would even gladly take a Denzel Perryman, who was very, very solid, was never going to be a first round pick, but developed from his freshman to senior season. And we don't even have those on the defense where you know you're going to get solid production out of this guy and at this position.
Yeah, I have to go back to Michael Jackson, to a guy who developed, who wasn't much when he got here, and Rumpf, who's criticized for his recruiting effort, did do a nice job developing him. But you're right, Mike. It's not a lot of guys that you can think of that's true.
Yeah. So to me, again, it comes back to recruiting. And I do all these charts, I track all this information, I write all these stories on, you know, I did it last year on who Miami sent to the draft and how the numbers, you know, they're still getting guys drafted, Walter. You know, I think I wrote this in my story last year, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I think they're still top 10 in terms of NFL production just within the last 10 to 5 years. So it's not like they're not putting guys in the league. The problem is none of those guys are developing into stars. Like if you look at the NFL roster right now, all 32 NFL teams, and you say, well, where are the Canes? Okay, well, Shaq Quarterman's a backup linebacker in Jacksonville. DJ Dallas is like the third string running back in Seattle. Jonathan Garvin is like a backup for the Packers. Sheldrick Redwine, another guy who plays in spurts for the Browns. Like there's not the Pro Bowlers. There's not these special players that Miami used to produce. And it's not just recent history, but long-term history. I mean, you know, basically what you have now in the NFL as far as guys that are stars that are making impacts is like Calais Campbell. And he's in, what, year 13?
And Manny, I think the sad thing about that is you see all this talent in Miami's backyard go to other schools and then go to the NFL and become those players. Mm-hmm. It's just Miami used to get those players in recruiting. Now they don't anymore.
And it's hard, Mike. It really is. And I've said this many times. Whoever the head coach at Miami is, I know Walter thinks otherwise, but I'm in firm belief that this is one of the toughest jobs in the country, because you have this level of expectations where, well, you have this great backyard. You have to get these kids. Well, guess what? It's been 17, 18 years since Miami's been relevant in the national championship picture. So all of these kids, the same way they change high schools 400 times, right, in South Florida, that they all want to go play at Central and Northwestern and whoever's winning a championship. That's what they want to do when they go to college. They don't want to come to a school that loses 62-26 to North Carolina. Like, every time one of those losses happens, every time Miami loses to an FIU or loses to Duke or loses to Louisiana Tech or falls behind 21-0 in a bowl game, what happens? Those elite recruits that are watching, right? What do? I don't want to go play for the school that they laugh at. And if they do come to Miami, it's because their parents and the people who care about them really want them to stay close to home.
So it's a never-ending cycle of them not getting the players good enough to win, them not winning, then the top talent doesn't come because they're not winning. It's a cycle that needs to be broken at some point, but it's where do you start? Do you start do you start winning games with average talent and that attracts the top talent, or do you get the top talent first and then you start winning?
Well, I think Manny started to break that chain, the recruiting job he did coming off of 6-7. I give him a lot of credit for that.
Well, he did, and I think I also give COVID-19 a lot of credit for that also, Walter, because let's face it, a lot of these kids didn't end up...
That's Miami's advantage that I've been saying for about 90 years, because where they are on the map, they have those players in the backyard, COVID or not COVID. And that's the difference that Nebraska will never have. Nebraska produces five players a year. They have to go outside their state to get every single player they get.
When I look back to what Howard Schnellenberger did, and you, Walter, I was a kid back then. You were a teenager, maybe an adult. What Howard Schnellenberger did was he hired a bunch of badass coaches, right? Didn't he have a bunch of really good coaches around him, guys who went on to bigger and better things? And those guys,
he also kind of sold the NFL. Remember, he came off of Shula's staff, and he had the cachet of being an NFL guy. And these guys want to get to the NFL. So I think he sold that as well. And he said, he made the famous comment, I think you're going to get to it, but the state of Miami, right? From wherever he said down, I don't know if it's Palm Beach or Orlando down south.
I will say this, while there was always a state of Miami, it wasn't branded as the state of Miami when Howard started. And I don't think he faced nearly the same level of competition for recruits as Manny Diaz had. Alabama was Alabama then, but it wasn't Alabama that came into South Florida and got a boatload of great Miami kids. They were winning with kids from all over the country. But
schools have always come down. If you look at Elliott Walker to Pitt and Busta Rhymes, Oklahoma schools, Elvis Peacock, all these great names from all those years ago,
right?
Schools will come down here and pick off these top players like they're still doing now, because there's all these great athletes and just Miami. In fact, there wasn't, obviously there wasn't FIU and FAU back then, but I think, I was reading something in The Athletic, actually recently, that Arizona and Arizona State, I don't think they got one player out of Arizona this year. I don't think they got a single one. I could be wrong about that, but they did a really poor job of recruiting their own state. So, and there's opportunities. Schools see that, man. Schools see like, hey, Arizona, not that they have the amount of players that Florida has, but whatever top players are there, they can be picked off.
Right.
And I know Saban sees that, and he's been seeing it, and other schools see it. I mean, there was a time Rutgers, on the first time under Schiano, he was making a living coming down here because he knows even if I get the sixth choice of Florida kids, that's still way better than what I have in New Jersey.
Right.
Well, so here's my question for you two, because you guys are down there. You understand, I guess, the high school kids, trying to decide where to go to school. If Miami was a top 10 team top 5-10 team every year, between 5-10, mm-hmm. right? Just outside the college football playoff, but always playing Clemson in the ACC championship game. Wouldn't you think that, sure, it's a lot harder to recruit South Florida and all the top guys down here now, back when Howard Schnellenberger did. But wouldn't you think if Miami could sell that, these top kids would prefer to stay home if Miami was relevant? Because I feel like that's the thing where it's, yes, it's harder to recruit. And yes, you're going to have programs like Ohio State and Alabama and Clemson coming in to South Florida, getting, recruiting these top guys. But if they already had a program like that down here, they wouldn't leave. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right, Mike. I think a lot of these kids naturally get pushed to the University of Miami by their peers and people who want them to stay home and help the program win. I think it's almost as if the embarrassing losses to me have hurt more than, you know, losing to Clemson or losing to, you know, some really good team. I think it's the embarrassment of FIU. Like when I was talking to Leonard Taylor in March last year about Miami, he's like, dude, they lost FIU. Like that was his sort of reasoning, like why he wasn't going to come to Miami. And that to me in a nutshell is what I think it's more of the embarrassment of, do you want to go play for that team that gets booed, that gets beat 62-26, you know? And
I think there's some of that, but I also think it varies kid to kid. I think there's some kids like the Boses, you know, they're more worldly. Their father, you know, has, I'm sure is well-to-do. He was a former NFL player. And, you know, they have roots there in Ohio and stuff. And they're probably going to leave regardless. There are other kids like Duke Johnson, no matter who the coach, he was going to stay. And maybe whatever their situation, maybe they're raised by a single mom and they want to be home close to their family.
I think it's beating out the top local kids for Florida State, for Clemson, for Alabama, the schools that regionally down here dominate. I think, look, Miami's beaten Alabama for some talented kids in the past. Why? Because maybe the playing situation was better at Miami. But they were contenders for it because they were decent enough, because people were excited enough over Manny Diaz's defense and the turnover chain. There's ways that you can lure kids who are on the fence. I just think.
But the top talent isn't coming here.
They were not in the past. I would say Leonard Taylor and James Williams are hands down the best players that they've recruited in a long time.
But I think both of you would agree with this, though. You can't. If you want to compete with the likes of the top programs in the country, you can't just have two players like that every recruiting class. You need to have a good chunk of those every single class. And sure, it's hard, but that's the only way to compete with if you want to compete.
And I would also say the other aspect is you also have to be good at knowing who the busts are, because this area in South Florida, as good as it is, as great as it is at producing guys who go on to the NFL and even under the radar guys like Hollywood Brown, right? Antonio Brown's nephew or cousin who's now with the Ravens, who was basically, I think, a two-star kid coming out of here, and maybe a Gregory Rousseau, right? You have to be good at identifying a guy who, you know, see him playing wide receiver and safety in high school and say, no, you got to put your hand on the ground and be a pass rusher. Like, you have to continue to do that, but I also think you got to continue or start to stop recruiting, you know, the Mark Popes of the world who are five-star guys in the eyes of all the recruiting analysts, but yet his game doesn't translate to the college level. He doesn't perform the same way he did in high school. Like, that's the other aspect. I think they've had a lot of busts as well. They've gotten good players. And they've signed guys that ultimately, you know, Christian Williams is a perfect example, right? Former Alabama commitment. He comes down to Miami. You say, hey, we're going to play you. You're going to be a really good cornerback here. And then after the first week of the season, he's not playing. And so he says, I'm out of here. I'm in the transfer portal. So Manny Diaz has to get better at player management, right? It's reading who the busts are and then also knowing, you know, hey, if we're going to give this kid a scholarship and we're going to make him a big time part of this program, how do we know that he's really invested? He's not going to jump in the transfer portal just because we're not playing him right away. It's a lot trickier. That's why I say it's a tougher job, Walter. That's for all those reasons. I think this is a tougher job than any other job in South Florida when it comes to coaching.
But also put yourself in the shoes of these kids, these young men. Let's say you're Patrick Surtain Jr. And now Nick Saban lands his helicopter on the football field, and, you know, he's wooing you in the SEC and all this. You know, some of these kids are going to be susceptible to that, and his father is well-to-do also. I think those kids are harder to keep home. They're well-to-do. They come from wealthy families. I've been in Patrick Surtain's house. It's beautiful. You know, and so you're going to lose some of those guys, and that's okay. And I think the other thing, if you go and watch what Jimmy Johnson, the legend and a great judge of talent, a great recruiter, and okay, you're not going to get all of them, but then you go into Texas and you get a few from there. You go into Jersey, you look for those situations. What I said about Arizona, like, Arizona's not keeping their in-state guys. Maybe they'd want a change of scenery to come to Miami, still warm weather. You go into New Jersey, look at, they signed three kids out of New York that were, you know, defensive linemen that seemed to have some potential. So I'm not putting it all like they have to get every single, you know, South Florida kids. Some of them you're just going to lose for the reasons I said. But you have to, You have to do well down here, obviously. Then you have to pick up guys in other states. And something that Mike said, you have to develop and you have to have a system, which I think we have now offensively. And we have to have a system. I think it goes. So all this goes hand in hand where the next man up can be successful because the system works. The coaching is tip top. The techniques that they're teaching work. And so you're not so reliant on whether you get a kid who is more have a worldview and was never, he wanted to see like who among us, like I think it should, if I'm in that situation, I might want to go to Southern Cal. I might want to go, you know, to someplace else different. You know, when I was a kid and a young man, I went to California. I always dreamed about California. I went out there and I took a job out there in the San Francisco Bay Area. And so if I did that, these kids might have the same, like, you know, same mindset, but then you can supplement your local recruiting, which you have a huge advantage, as I keep saying, and then pick up guys in other states.
Well, they've tried. They've gotten a few here and there. Obviously, Jake Garcia is not from here. He's a big time get for them. I know Tyreek Austin Cave up in New Jersey. Certainly, Jason Blissett, another kid that they have high hopes for, was a 4-star kid up in the New York area. Jared Harrison Hunt is not from down here. You know, they've tried. The question is, can those guys something big and really help you win games? We'll see. I know we got to start wrapping this thing up, man. I appreciate both of you guys coming on. Hopefully, 2021 is a better year for everybody, including Miami and the fan base. I know that they want more and more improvement. And certainly I like covering a team that wins more. And we don't have to sit here all day talking about what they've got to do to get to that next level. But we'll see. We'll see if Manny Diaz, what kind of changes he makes here in the weeks and months ahead. How much transfer portal action we see here. They've got 3 scholarships left, and I think they're certainly going to use them in the transfer portal. So we'll see what positions they address and how they can and upgrade this team going forward.
I'm the eternal optimist. I don't think it's, you know, that far away. Before we wrap it up, Navarro, give us one sentence on De'Aaron King. How long do you think we can't close the show without addressing that? How long, when do you predict he'll be,
announcement? I mean, De'Aaron last night tweeted out, you know, he doesn't know why this happened to him. I think it's a serious knee injury in the sense where he's going to be out months and needing to rehab. So I would assume that there's a chance he could come back in September and be ready for the start of the season. We know guys come back from ACLs and MCLs quicker than before. And De'Aaron is a hellacious athlete, so I would think he would train really hard and try to come back. But there's a possibility they may not have him for the opener. We'll see. I mean, there's no official word, Walter. I haven't called his brother or anybody in his family to talk. I know that today they were doing more sort of medical work and examining his knee and so forth. So it'll probably get leaked soon. What the result of all of that is. But personally, looking at the situation, looking at his body language, seeing the tweet, I would assume this is a long-term injury. And in the end, does it really matter what it is? I think can he be ready for Alabama? That's what everybody wants to know. And we won't know that answer, I think, till August. We really won't have any clear idea till August.
As I said, I want what's best for De'Aaron. And if he said he was going to the NFL, I would have supported it because that guy's been great for the program. I know the fans are very appreciative, and it just sucked to see him down on the ground. It didn't seem that serious. The way it wasn't a hard hit, it wasn't a dirty hit. It didn't seem like it was, you know, that big a deal. And I'm just hoping that he comes back by July, and maybe Garcia and Van Dyke can get that work in spring practice. But I'm the eternal optimist, right, man. That's what I'm hoping.
Final word from you, Mike Zimmerman.
I'm just nervous that what this program will look like without De'Aaron King. I've said this time and time this season, he covered up a lot of holes on this team. I think he bailed out the defense a lot of the time. I think he bailed out the offensive line a lot of the times. So I guess I'm just nervous what this team would look like without him. And he's not there to, I guess, carry this team and maybe all cover right up some of those holes.
Well, we will see if he's ready for September 4th in Atlanta. Terrence Lewis, the 5-star recruit linebacker out of Miami Central. I guess he's going to decide between Miami and Maryland on Saturday, this coming Saturday, January 2nd, the All-American Bowl Declaration Day. So
we don't need any linebackers. We'll see. Yeah, we do.
I was going to say that Terrence Lewis actually was not really considering Miami until the past couple weeks.
It's been this ongoing flirtation back and forth, and I've asked people on the staff, are you guys recruiting him? I've been told no, then I've been told yes. I've asked, are you guys considering him? Is he going to come to Miami? And I've been told he didn't have us in the final two. So, it's a whole lot of mixed messages. If they get him, great. Let's see if he's any good. I'm not going to sit here and celebrate mm-hmm. the signing of a five-star linebacker who, you know, to me, didn't really seem committed to Miami or wanting to come to Miami and maybe is only picking Miami now because he doesn't have a lot of other choices left. So,
But if he can play, who cares?
But I also believe that a lot of that comes into play in terms of attitude and the way that they carry themselves. So we'll see. We'll see if he's good. He's good, and that helps Miami. Great. If he goes to Maryland, oh well. I'm just throwing it out there that he's making his announcement at 3 p.m. on Saturday. All right, that's it. We're gonna wrap it up with that, I guess. Mike, Walter, thank you guys very much. You've listened to Wide Right, final episode of 2020. We will be back. Soon, don't know when exactly, but we'll be back soon with more Wide Right in the future. 305-954-568. This is the state of Miami. Y'all know y'all come down that way.